Am I doing the right thing, Bones? Once I said man rose above primitiveness by vowing, I will not kill today.
But you can't let this thing destroy over 80 million lives either.
Bridge to World X. Welcome aboard a brand new episode of Enterprise Incidents with Scott and Steve. I'm Scott Mance.
And I'm Steve Morris, and I am both really excited to talk about this episode, but also really excited to talk to our guest.
We have a very, very special guest. We are doing our deep dive into the animated series. We are now on our third episode of the animated series with Enterprise Incidents. It is One of Our Planets is Missing, and we are very, very excited to welcome our very special guest, who, among other things, is the writer of Star Trek the Motion Picture. Like, that's the actual movie Star Trek the Motion Picture. He also wrote all 10 of the Star Trek logbooks, which adapted the episodes of the animated series and expanded upon them greatly. He also wrote many other books for Star Trek and for Star Wars, including a book. When I picked it up, I was sure this was going to be the next film after the original Star Wars, which they now call The New Hope, Splinter of the Mind's Eye, which I still have my original copy. He is the writer of more than 20 standalone novels, most recently, I believe, 2018's Relic, and he is the winner of the 2008 Grandmaster Award from the International Association of Media Tie-In Writers. What an honor and a pleasure. Very excited to welcome Alan Dean Foster. Welcome, Alan, to Enterprise Incidents.
Hi, nice to be aboard.
Well, the first question really for you, Alan, is how did you get into Star Trek at all? You know, I'm assuming with the original series. And what did you think of the transition from the original show to the animated show?
I was a graduate student at UCLA, and I had discovered the film department and decided that I might give some thought to becoming a writer instead of becoming a lawyer. I sold a couple of short stories while I was at UCLA. And since I was writing screenplays and teleplays for classes, I thought I would try a screenplay to one of my favorite shows, which was Star Trek. So I ended up writing a two-part episode, which I then submitted to Norway Productions, and got a very nice letter back saying, we liked your script very much. Please resubmit for our fourth season. Of course, That was kind of my reaction. Possibly a deeper sigh, but similar enough. So I filed that. And then years went by, and I ended up writing a couple of novelizations for Ballantine, soon to become Del Rey Books. And Judy Lynn Del Rey, a very remarkable woman who was then the editor at what became Del Rey Books, had found a missing piece in the contract that Paramount had with Bantam Books. Apparently the contract with Bantam Books said that Bantam had the rights to do prose adaptations of every episode of Star Trek throughout the universe forever till the end of time, but neglected to include the term animated film in the contract. Judy Lynn found that missing piece and promptly bought those rights. And in fact, I spent a really interesting couple of hours at Paramount watching Judy Lynn dismantle one of their high-priced lawyers who tried to convince her that that was not the case and that Del Rey could not buy those rights. It was a wonderfully entertaining couple of hours, and I wish I'd had a camera. No phone cameras back in that day. Judy Lynn acquired those rights, and because I had done some novelizations for Del Rey, asked if I would be interested in novelizing the animated show. So I said, sure, but I can't do one episode per book. There's no way that I can get an 80,000-word, 75,000-word novel out of a 20-minute cartoon script. So she said, do whatever you want. So I thought about it, and I thought, well, I can get a novella about 25,000 words out of each 20-minute teleplay. Let's do that. I'll do three per book, and I'll throw in a few paragraphs here and there that tries to tie them together, however marginally, so that when people are reading them, they don't have an abrupt switch from one story to the other. This worked until episode 7, or I should say Star Trek Log 7, where I got a call from Judy Lynn and says, And she said, she was very direct, Judy Lynn, even though she was a little person. She said, you can't believe how these things are selling. You have to get four books out of the four remaining teleplays. And I said, well, if I could have done that, I probably would have done that from the beginning. And she said, I don't care how you do it. You have to do it. So one was due, one was coming up. So I thought, well, what am I going to do? Quickly. So I thought, well, I'll do what I've been doing, which is get a novella out of one of the four last stories. And then I'll do 2/3 original material for the last part of the book. And for the last 2/3 of Log 7, I went back and I picked up the screenplay or the teleplay that I had submitted to Norway Productions years ago while I was at UCLA. And that became the last 2/3 of Log 7. And that was how I got involved with Star Trek that way.
You said that Star Trek was one of your favorite TV shows. And I was wondering what drew you to Star Trek. What was the thing about it that got you excited?
I loved, on the most basic level, I loved science fiction. There was no science fiction on television, with a very few exceptions. I still remember watching Science Fiction Theater, which actually did real science fiction stories back in the early 50s when I was a kid in New York. Wonderful stuff in black and white, but there wasn't any Rocky Jones Space Ranger and all of that. There wasn't any real science fiction on television with the exception of certain episodes of The Twilight Zone, Outer Limits, which basically was science fiction plus Monster of the Week, and along came Star Trek, which to me was not only real science fiction, but science fiction away from Earth. We got away from this solar system. That's why the movie Forbidden Planet was so important. It was the first film to do that. And even though the budget was obviously low, they did the best they could, and they tried to do, and largely succeeded, real science fiction. There were certain things that they had to do to accord with the conventions of contemporary television at the time, but they still managed to break ground in numerous areas. And I watched it because it was real science fiction. So it was the only thing on the air like it. It wasn't like you could change the channel and there would be another show like Star Trek.
Well, when it came to switching the channel, if you were going to switch the channel, during the 66 and 67 and 68, you would have found Lost in Space, which is definitely not a science fiction series like Star Trek. But, you know, the interesting thing to me, Alan, is that throughout the 70s, especially the early 70s, I think this is the most fascinating time period through all of Star Trek, because it had gone off the air, but the original episodes were in syndication, got very popular. The conventions were starting up, and the animated series turned out to be just an animated version of the original show. And that did very well, winning an Emmy in its second season. And you're writing these books. You have the Banta books, the photo novels, and so on. So there was a time period where Star Trek was going to come back to TV, and then it came back as a motion picture. So how did you get to write the story for Star Trek, the motion picture?
When Roddenberry and Norway Productions people, they were going back and forth for years with Paramount. Paramount would bounce around, say, well, we're going to do it as a movie. And then they'd change their minds. No, we're going to bring back the TV series. And this went on for years. Meanwhile, I was doing the logs and 7 original stories for Peter Pan Records, which is something else to talk about another time, where I actually got to write original Star Trek. But they finally decided, no, we're going to, as I understand it, bring it back as a TV series. And they then started soliciting ideas, story treatments, for proposed one-hour episodes. I submitted 3 ideas. The one that was picked was the one that eventually became the motion picture. They decided they were going to open the new series, this is how far along they were, as a 2-hour movie for television. At this point, Star Wars comes along, makes buckets of money. Somebody decides, well, maybe we should do it again as a movie. The apocryphal story is that Charles Bludhorn, who was the chairman of the board of Gulf and Western, which owned Paramount, his 12-year-old daughter said, Daddy, why can't we have a Star Trek movie? This is how things sometimes get done in Hollywood. Either way, they decided, no, we're not going to do the TV series. We're going to do it as a movie. I think what happened, and I wasn't there because I wasn't privy to the inner workings of all of these negotiations, is that somebody or several somebodies at Norway, whether it was Roddenberry or other people, said, let's throw something at them quickly so that maybe we can get this budgeted and get started on it before they change their minds again and we have to go back to the TV series. Here was my story, designed to carry 2 hours, and that's what they threw at them. And if I remember my history correct, they had a big meeting, at which time Michael Eisner, who was then the head of Paramount, held up the treatment that I had written and said, this is our movie. Mm-hmm. Now, that's what I've read from the histories, at which point I became an instant non-person, because now we're not talking about a TV show or TV episode. We're talking about a big budget motion picture. And I was a nobody in Hollywood and had no pull. And it was not that glorious moment of recognition. And, well, it's all been documented, like I said. And anyway, the story became the movie. The first 5 minutes of that movie is all mine. After that, you start to see changes here and there.
Sure.
I would have been happy to give my opinion for free. That's always a warning sign in Hollywood. Well, guy's going to do something for free. What does he really want? What I really wanted was, as a fan, to see the best movie possible up on the screen. But that's, you can't convince people in the business of that. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got involved with the making of the movie.
What did you, is a dangerous question for me to ask, because yeah. I've had similar experiences, but what did you feel when you finally saw it?
I thought it was very good. I thought it needed editing. I did not know at the time I saw it what had gone on behind the scenes with the original special effects company being fired, Doug Trumbull having to rush like crazy to redo and finish special effects because the film had been promised to theater owners to be in the theater by a certain date. So for a rush job, I thought it was exceptional. For a non-rush job, I thought it was a pretty good movie. I know they did certain things that maybe they didn't want to do, but I can just see somebody going into the vice president of production's office at some big studio and saying, we want to make a film about the next stage up in human evolution. And what you would get are blank stares. And do you want some coffee? Let's talk about this out in the hall. And it just wouldn't fly. That's why none of Olaf Stapledon's books have ever been made into film. Mm. Might be one day. But
You know what, Alan? I got to say that I was 11 years old when I saw Star Trek The Motion Picture when it came out. And I loved it immediately. I was just a kid. I'm 11 years old. But the thing is that over the years, over these, you know, last 40 plus years, 43, 44 years now, I don't think any film has aged better than Star Trek The Motion Picture. And certainly so much more has become reevaluated about that film. And it's been redone. You know, they did a director's cut in 2001. They refurbished the director's cut just last year. I wonder if you had a chance to see this newer version and if your thoughts about Motion Picture have changed since then.
I haven't had a chance to see it, so obviously I'm not going to comment on something I haven't seen.
Sure.
But I think the reason that it may have achieved the kind of success and longevity that you just mentioned is because it's a film about an idea, whereas so many films, large-scale films, are about blowing things up. And it's very interesting. If you look at the film, all of the, if you will, blowing up action takes place in the first 5-6 minutes, and then there's none of that in the rest of the film, really.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. It's all about an idea and discussing an idea and communicating with an alien life form. That doesn't sound like the basis for a long film. And yet, years go by, and we get a film based remarkably on a science fiction story by a science fiction writer called Arrival, which is essentially about the same idea, is a fabulous film, and was easier to bring off because you can do those kind of effects now much more quickly and cheaply. But I think they both have that in common.
Well, it's real science fiction. I mean, it's just where you started when you were talking about those shows, is the difference between adventure in a science fiction setting and real science fiction, you know?
Yes, yes.
Well, Alan, I got to say too that one of the reasons why I think the motion picture has not only held up but evolved on its own to become reevaluated and reappreciated is, you know, back in the 70s, you know, when all these other you know, they were trying to do their own version of Star Wars, like Battle Beyond the Stars and The Black Hole. You know, Star Trek was 2001: A Space Odyssey, which was also about human evolution. So I think that's a big reason why motion picture holds up as well as it does. And I got to say, Alan, that, you know, while we do these deep dives, and since we've been doing the animated series especially, I have not watched the animated show in quite some time. So when I watched One of Our Planets Is Missing for the first time in, I would say, a really long time, I was noticing how similar some of the story was, and how maybe this particular animated episode, maybe this inspired your story for Phase 2 and eventually Star Trek The Motion Picture. Is that something that you were conscious of?
No, that's a great segue, but it doesn't work in this case. What inspired me, and it wasn't inspiration, Roddenberry gave me a 2-page outline called Robots Return and said, see if you can make something of this. And that's where it came from.
Right.
Well, I took 2 pages and made 30 or 40 pages or whatever it was out of it. And I did not recall seeing One of Our Planets Is Missing at that time. But you're absolutely right, at least at the beginning, about certain similarities. No question about it. People have mentioned another Star Trek episode called The Changeling.
Sure.
Which I also did not recall while I was working on the treatment. And I suppose what that says is that similar large-scale ideas in science fiction tend to inspire writers to work with them. And I don't think that name escapes me at the moment, but whoever wrote One of Our Planets Is Missing, and Roddenberry, and myself, you know, all were feeding off each other's idea. I really do think we came about them independently.
That is a great segue, Alan, because the writer of One of Our Planets Is Missing is Mark Daniels. Right. And Steve, I'm sure you recognize that name.
Of course. He was the director of I Love Lucy.
Yeah, he was the director of I Love Lucy. He was also the director of 14 episodes of the original series, which makes him tied with Joseph Pevney of having directed the most episodes of the original series, 14. Now, that is counting The Menagerie as one complete episode, which the second episode of which was actually credited to Robert Butler. But Daniels actually wrote a script for the original series called The Beast for season 4, and it was never produced because there never was a season 4. But One of Our Planets Is Missing, the first version that Daniels wrote, and it was his first time writing a Star Trek episode, it was an hour long. Well, as you know, this is a much, much shorter version of Star Trek, so that had to be brought down. Daniels did 4 drafts, the final polish of which was done by, of course, Dorothy DC Fontana, who was the associate producer and story editor for the animated series. The episode was directed by Hal Sutherland, who, of course, directed all the first season episodes of the animated series. It was the 7th episode of the animated series to be produced. By that, I mean the production order number was 22007, but it was the 3rd episode to air, which aired on September 22nd, 1973, making it the 82nd episode of Star Trek to air out of, if you include all of the shows, every single series, the 82nd episode out of now, as of this taping, 873 episodes of Star Trek. Alan, what do you think of when you hear that to this day and counting, there have been 873 episodes of Star Trek?
It says to me that there's something more there than just a basic television show idea. There has to be something there, not just because there are a lot of fans who support the shows. There has to be something, some kernel of story idea in the idea of Star Trek that allows it to go on so long. And I think that simply, if you had to pick something, I would have to say it's human curiosity about the universe around us. Hmm. And only science fiction really does that. And the fact that Star Trek was around and is around to do that speaks to the fact that everybody from episode one is still exploring that basic notion. It's just different approach, a different look at the same subject maybe, and you can go on with this forever and ever because everything is possible in science fiction. That's what attracted me to writing it in the first place. What you, sure. You can do anything you want. If you can do anything you want, you have no limitations. You can't really do a show, or at least I don't think you can, that will run with spinoffs, 800 episodes about a detective working in Connecticut. The material just isn't there. But when you have the whole galaxy or the whole universe to play with, you have unlimited horizons, no pun intended. And that's why I think it sticks around. It also does it better than anything else that's tried to imitate it. And I think the underlying reason for that is the basic humanity of the show. It's Star Trek is, this has been said by many other people over and over, Star Trek is basically an optimistic view of humanity and humanity's future, and we really don't have a lot of that. I mean, I've been watching movies for the Oscars, and the last one I watched was The Banshees of Inisherin.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Beautifully photographed, beautifully acted, and unutterably depressing. And you're not going to get somebody who wants to watch 800 episodes of that. I also watched a film called RRR, which I think was the best picture of last year and only managed an Oscar nomination for Best Song. But that's probably because it was hard for people to see. It's not Star Trek, but it has an essentially, at heart, optimistic view of humanity.
I love RRR.
Good.
Yeah, I love it. So I'm glad that you singled that movie out, Alan, because I agree with you. It should have gotten a lot more attention during the nominations for the Oscars. Steve, I want to ask you, when it came time to rewatch One of Our Planets is Missing, what did you think?
So it's so funny because when we were doing the original series and you'd ask me this question, I have a whole lifetime of memories of watching an episode many, many times. And with these, many of them are going to be like I'm watching them for the first time because I saw them as a kid. I watched them maybe once as an adult, and this time I was so impressed with this particular episode. This episode really, top to bottom, feels like an episode of Star Trek. Yes, all the jinky things about the animation and the repeated music and all of that sort of stuff, that's all totally there. But plot-wise and structure-wise, this felt like Star Trek. I really did enjoy this one.
I agree. I got to say, gentlemen, that when I did my rewatch of this episode again for the first time in long, 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 long time, I was impressed by how much of the three, now our third episode, the doing a deep dive here on Enterprise Incidents, this is the one that feels more like Star Trek than the previous two, which are still very good, especially yesteryear. And I was surprised that the true elements that make Star Trek so special, in terms with, in this particular case, communication, compassion, very, very high stakes, a very, very dire race against time in a couple of cases for the power drain on the Enterprise and then saving the planet, the people, 82 million people. There are very high stakes in here. And it's an extremely thorough and I would say authentic vintage episode of Star Trek, yet it takes all these elements that you would find in a 50-minute episode and it puts them into a 24-minute episode. Alan, what did you think on your rewatch of One of Our Planets is Missing?
I was struck by the fact that, first of all, like you said, it feels like real Star Trek. It doesn't feel like something that's, we're going to write something for Saturday morning kids TV. If that episode had been done as an episode of the original show, it would have fit in there perfectly. The other thing was, this is one of the advantages of animation, and I'm an old animation buff, there are certain things, particularly back when the animated show was produced, that you simply could not do and make believable in film, let alone on TV. And so you adapt, you have the chance to use a medium that lets you do anything you want, animation. And that was one of the other things that struck me. As far as the limited animation goes, the other thing is that if your story and your script is good enough, you don't need elaborate animation to make it work. I grew up watching a show called Crusader Rabbit when I was in my 40s. This was the first show done by the guys who did George of the Jungle. And all limited animation, but all really, really terrific scripts and voice acting. And rewatching One of Our Planets Is Missing, I was thinking to myself, it's good that it was done this way. And yes, it would be wonderful if it had, at that time, Disney-style animation, but it wasn't necessary to convey the story and the meaning behind the story.
I agree, and I just got to say, too, that Steve knows this, and a lot of our enterprisers, our listeners, have commented on this on our Facebook page, that when they were growing up in the early 70s, they would hold their tape recorder up to the TV to record the episodes because, you know, Alan, this is before VCRs. And I certainly did that. And I did that with the original show. I did that with a couple of the animated shows. So if I'm just listening to the audio of it and I'm listening to an original episode and I'm listening to an animated episode, I'm not looking at the animation. I'm hearing the voices of William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy, DeForest Kelly, and so on and so on. And I'm thinking, this is Star Trek. So I agree with you 100%. Alan, is what I'm saying.
I just think what I think is interesting is that, because it goes to what you were talking about before, Alan, of if your science fiction is about action and, you know, giant special effects and adventure and stuff like that, which is what it is today with Marvel movies and things like that, you can't do that. If your show is about ideas, then you can.
It's a difficult balance to strike, but Dune is a good example of how to do that. With Dune, you have big ideas and you also have plenty of action. But that's special because it's based on a very important book. It's not somebody sitting down to write a 120-page screenplay. That just doesn't happen that often. But you can strike that balance. That's what drives me nuts about so much film science fiction, is you can have both. You don't have to blow everything up, and you don't have to have two people sitting there like it's a French film discussing Sartre's philosophy for 2 hours. You can have combination of both. And when you do that, and of course I'm really looking forward to Dune Part 2, then I think you've got true science fiction. You really do. And I think you not only can have both, I think you have to combine both, certainly if you're making a film. You can't just do all one or all the other. You could say there's no action in Arrival, but there's only no action in the sense that people aren't really blowing things up, with the exception of one sequence. Otherwise, it's just a lot of suspense. And that's different from blowing things up. But you can do it on a low budget. There's great films that, I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent here, but a film like Moon.
Oh, great movie.
Oh, great movie. Great movie, budget, yeah.
Real science fiction. Nothing blows up in it, but the suspense keeps you attached. And another film, Dark City, which Roger Ebert, who was a great film critic, put on his 10 best of the year films, because he's the only film critic who I felt actually read science fiction as opposed to just watching it. Doesn't get enough recognition, but a terrific film not made on an enormous budget. You can do this. And on the rare occasions when I still talk to somebody in the film business, I will point this out. I said, you don't need $100 million to make a really good science fiction film that people will go and see.
Alan, you are so speaking my language, and I literally made almost the exact speech you made in like executive development meetings going, no, it can have ideas and be exciting, I promise. And it doesn't usually sell.
It's even easier now because of what's happened, because of the advance in special effects. Look at a film like District 9, which is already several years old.
I was just going to say that one. Amazing. Totally agree.
Amazing.
Terrific
movie,
film, yeah. Amazing film, and very low budget, but story.
Absolutely. So as much as I would love to talk science fiction and movies in general with you all day, would you like to know what was going on back in the day that this episode aired, which was in September of 1973?
Sure. Oh, by all means.
So it aired on September 22nd. So this is the week before in the world. On September 17th, Illinois became the first state to make Martin Luther King Jr. Day a state holiday. On September 18th, King Hussein of Jordan issued a general amnesty for all Palestinian terrorists in Jordan, including Abu Daoud, who is the leader of Black September, and that's the group that carried out the massacre of Israeli athletes in Munich. Oh, and this is all the things that are leading up to the Yom Kippur War. This one, you know, Scott, how occasionally I go down a bit of a rabbit hole because I read a story that's so bizarre. I knew nothing about this. Also on the 18th, Graham Parsons of the Byrds died at the age of 26 of a drug overdose. That was not the rabbit hole I went down. Apparently, he had announced very publicly that he wanted to be cremated at Joshua Tree. So naturally, the next day, his manager stole the body from LAX, drove in a borrowed hearse to Joshua Tree, and attempted to cremate it himself by pouring 5 gallons of gasoline into the open coffin and lighting it on fire, which just resulted in a huge fireball. The police show up. They flee from the police. Apparently, the manager said that they were unencumbered by sobriety at the time. They got away from the police, were arrested several days later, but because there was no law on the books in California about stealing a dead body, they just got fined $750 for stealing and destroying a coffin. And
That's amazing. I remember back in 2004, I think Johnny Knoxville made a movie. I forget the title, but it was at Sundance about that very wild, true story. Yeah.
Also,
there's a great stolen body story involving Errol Flynn and John Huston, but that's probably a real digression. So I'll let you go on.
But now I'm going to have to find out about that one too. On September 20th, it was the Battle of the Sexes between Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs, and Billie Jean King, of course, defeated Bobby Riggs in straight sets. On the same day, the Concorde landed in the U.S. for the first time. And also on the same day, Jim Croce died in a plane crash at the age of 30. And then on September 22nd, Sadat of Egypt and Assad of Syria officially gave the order to launch the attack on Israel on October 6th. So that is what was happening in the world when this episode came on the air. Shall we get into it?
Let's get into One of Our Planets is Missing.
Well, and we start, as always, with a captain's log, and we hear that there is a huge cosmic cloud moving into the fringes of our galaxy, and it's heading towards the farthest inhabited Federation planet, which is Mantilles.
According to the stardate, 5371.3, this takes place just 2¾ days after the end of the events of yesteryear. Yes, I did reread all of this before our conversation today, Alan. But if you go by stardate order, then just like yesteryear, this takes place between the events of the Empath and the Mark of Gideon.
That's interesting.
No, I'm sorry. I had no direction, by the way, on Star Trek on log dates.
Oh.
It was one of the things I did was come up with the idea of calling the book Star Trek Logs and then throwing in dates at the beginning, just like in the show. But I had no control over the actual dates that were used. So if they are out of chronological sequence, that is not my fault.
We hear from Eric's.
It's immense. Twice the diameters of Saturn, Jupiter, and Neptune together.
Is this the first line we hear from him?
That is correct, Steve Morris. This is the first time we are hearing Lieutenant Arix speak. Lieutenant Arix, an alien with 3 arms and 3 legs, voiced by none other than James Doohan.
Yeah, it's too much. Too much, Jimmy. Sorry. Love you. Too much of his voice. And we see the cloud on screen, and a planet has disappeared. This is Alondra.
Captain, the planet seems to be breaking up. Its mass is definitely growing smaller.
Spock, is it possible the cloud consumes planets?
So Alan, a couple questions for you. One, when it came to adapting the animated series episodes, I'm wondering, did you go by the actual animated episode itself, or did you go by like an earlier draft of the script so you had time to write it?
Yeah, all I had to go by was the script. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know. I had seen some stills. I had no idea really what most of the characters looked like, but I was delighted to see 2 alien members of the Enterprise crew who are actually aliens for a change, Arix being one, and of course, Imres being the other.
Right, that's right.
And that's another advantage of animation.
How long did it take you to write your adaptation? And did some episodes take longer than others?
Well, to write an episode would generally take, a book would take 2 months. Mm-hmm. So all of the episodes took about the same time to write. So you're figuring, you know, roughly 3 weeks, 4 weeks at the most to write, to adapt an episode.
I'm curious, as you're filling them out to fill them up to novella length, are you doing that by going more into the internal life of the characters? Are you doing that by adding extra moments or things like that? What was your approach on how to fill those stories out a little bit?
It was the same way I approached every adaptation of films as well, which is all of those things you just said. One of the nice things about being able to write a novelization is I can get inside the characters' heads and show what they're thinking, mm-hmm. which you cannot do very easily or well in the actual episode itself. Is particularly fun, again, with the alien characters who are supposed to think like aliens. So I got to get inside Kirk's head and Spock's head and everybody else. And as people do when they're thinking about things, a lot of times they're not thinking entirely directly about what they're doing at the moment. They'll have a little digression. For example, someone like Scott might go off and think about, might go off and think about, this reminds him of a time when he was back in engineering school and there was this insoluble problem, and how could he apply that to the situation at hand? None of that shows up in the episode,
sure.
But you get to do it in the book. When they show something, for example, like our giant cosmic cloud, I can go into more details about the science, which I love doing, and which film and TV science fiction often gets so bad that you just want to run screaming from the theater. I get to fix those things as well. And most of the time, not all of the time, they'll leave me alone to do that. So all of the things you said apply.
Well, one of the things I noticed, especially with regards to Yesteryear, the last episode we covered here, is that you gave a lot of backstory into the planet of the Guardian of Forever. And I just thought that was awesome because, I've never read in any other fanzine or book over these years this, the history of the planet with the time vortex and all the description about the ruined cities and all that. And in the case of one of our planets is missing, something is as simple as when it's said in the actual episode that the Enterprise is the only ship in the area to investigate the cloud, Kirk, in your book, in your adaptation, he does a half joke. He goes, "Of course, the Enterprise is the only ship in interception range." You don't see that in the episode itself, but it's a great addition to the story.
Well, I love doing stuff like that. That's for the reader. That's for the fans, because they're sitting there reading this, wanting something like that to be said.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right.
And you don't get it in the show.
And the cloud starts consuming the planet and then changes course.
That's impossible.
The course change is verified, sir. The cloud is now moving directly toward the inhabited planet.
What episodes, Scott, were you thinking about when you saw A, this giant thing consuming planets, and B, a big cloud suddenly change course?
Okay, so here's where the episode is both a great addition to the canon of Star Trek and also one that is a little derivative of the original series. So, of course, I thought of the Doomsday Machine, which was, in fact, directed by Mark Daniels. And I'm sure when he was writing this teleplay for One of Our Planets is Missing, he really, really proud of that, especially when it came to the Race Against Time. But, of course, I also thought about the Immunity Syndrome. I thought about a few episodes when I was watching this. I thought about Obsession. Stuff coming up where I thought about separate episodes. So I love that about this particular one, One of Our Planets is Missing, because of the way it ties into all of that, but maybe a little too on the nose. What about you, Steve?
Well, you hit the ones that I was thinking about, of course. And it's funny, at least at this point, three episodes in the animated series, I'm enjoying the references to other episodes. I'm not finding it to be derivative. Now, whether or not that's going to continue for the next many episodes, I don't know. But at this moment, that's how I'm feeling.
Jim, if we can't stop it, millions of people will die.
And then Spock comes in with saying, no, it could be more. It could consume planets, stars.
We do not know yet whether it has any selective ability, but it could be a threat to every planet in our galaxy.
So this is like big Star Trek themes right here.
Alan, when you were watching this, were you sort of like connecting the dots? And when you're watching the animated version of the story, did you think back to when you wrote it and expanded on it?
Well, I certainly thought back to when I wrote it and expanded on it. One of the things that you have to be careful with, since you point out all the connections with all the other episodes or similarities with the episodes that you mentioned, is I will expand and I will, you know, fix and adjust the science, and I'll go inside the characters' heads. But one thing I will not and cannot do is monkey around with the actual script itself. Mm-hmm, I can't right. suddenly say, on a small basis, I can't suddenly, just because I want to, have Uhura say something that Spock is saying in the episode. Mm-hmm. There's no justification or reason for that. Even though I might think she would deliver the line better for whatever reason, maybe because she's the communications officer, but I can't do that, because that's interfering with the original story. And also, when somebody's reading the adaptation, that would confuse the heck out of them. So I don't do that, and I can't go off on any kind of a tangent, however much I might enjoy the thought or the idea, that directly contradicts what's going on in the story as it's presented.
Understood.
It's a weird gig you have, because it's people who are coming to your book. They come to it because they love the episode. You know, they come to it because they know it, not because they don't know it. I'm sure some people were reading it who hadn't seen the episode, but the majority got to be fans. And so if you made those changes, it would hit them in the face in a way that wouldn't be fun.
No, you break the continuity, and that's the worst thing you can do in any story, is take people out of the story.
Yeah. Yep. Speaking of which, the next moment is the moment where I think this episode really got elevated.
Do we dare tell the people on Mentilis, try to save a few who could get away?
How much time do they have?
4 hours, 10 minutes, sir.
It's certain there'd be planet-wide panic.
Blind panic.
On the other hand, notifying them may still save some small fraction of the population, Captain.
This is a Star Trek question. It is, and what I love about it is there's no right answer. This isn't like an easy question to answer. This is a incredibly difficult question to answer.
Steve, I agree with you 100%. When Kirk makes that observation, it brought me back to the Kirk of the original series, who was weighed down by the burden of command decisions that might be deemed as extremely difficult, like the one that he faced in Operation Annihilate with the colonists who were, you know, affected by the alien parasites. And I have to say that compared to Operation Annihilate, which aired on a Thursday night on NBC in 1967, this was a Saturday morning cartoon. Very different yep. audience, but yet it is still very much like Star Trek. I mean, did you feel the same way, Alan, that like, wow, this is pretty heavy for a, you know, quote unquote kiddie show?
One of the best things about the animated show to me was that it did not talk down to its audience. Mm-hmm. I grew up reading Uncle Scrooge comic books, and Carl Barks, who wrote and drew those comics, never talked down to his audience. I never got the feeling reading those books as a kid that he was patronizing me because I was a kid. And you get the same feeling from the animated series. This is a pretty advanced topic, what you just mentioned there, for children to try and absorb and deal with. But they went ahead and did it anyway. They could have taken that out or simplified it, and the show could have gone on without it. But stuff like that is what you elevated is the right word. Elevated the stories in the shows.
And I actually love the solution they come up with of how to resolve the question, because the next question they ask is,
who's the governor of Mentilis, Jim?
Bob Wesley. He left Starfleet for the governorship. He's no hysteric.
Then tell him.
So the solution to whether or not we tell the people is dependent upon the leader. Different leader, they might have had a different solution.
And also a leader who Kirk is very familiar with. Kirk knew before we even met Bob Wesley for the first time when he was a Commodore in the Ultimate Computer, commanding the USS Lexington during the war games on the Enterprise when the Enterprise was hooked up by the M5 computer. So Governor Bob Wesley in the Ultimate Computer was played by Barry Russo, who also played the security chief Giamatto in The Devil in the Dark. But for for this animated episode, who voiced him, Steve?
Nichelle Nichols?
Close but no cigar. That's right. James Doohan, who I think I actually read that – well, I did read that James Doohan voiced 61 characters throughout the animated series. And it shows.
Yeah, it really does. And now, as we're going to contact Bob Wesley, the cloud reaches out and grabs them. And I think this looks pretty cool. I think visually, actually, this might be some of the best things we've seen in the animated series so far.
Agreed. I completely agree. I think everything that you're saying, Steve, and everything, Alan, that you're saying about the animated series being able to do things that the original series would not have been able to do, at least back in 66 or even 73, I think the animation is great.
They fire phasers. It's no good. They get pulled inside the cloud. The Enterprise shakes, and now objects are approaching them from the front and from the rear. And we hear,
"The objects are some form of highly charged gaseous antimatter."
"Captain, the power drain on the shields is too heavy to hold for any length of time."
This is like Doomsday Machine. We have the tension rising from these external forces. And then we ask Spock what his analysis is.
"It is possible this cloud in which we are entrapped is a living thing. The cloud is alive."
And that brings us to the end of Act One. So a couple things to say about this. Another element that makes this feel like vintage Star Trek is that Spock has the beginning of a theory. We've seen Spock have the beginnings of theories many times, most famously and perfectly in The Devil in the Dark. But, you know, in terms of the Enterprise sort of being seen as an invading organism, you know, of course I thought of the Immunity Syndrome, but I thought of a famous movie from 1966 that also had a spaceship being sort of seen as an invading virus, so to speak. And that is Fantastic Voyage.
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. I can see that.
These are the cloud's antibodies coming to attack the invading. I mean,
yep.
I do love the fact that they throw in something like just antimatter. Even we're not going to argue about whether it can exist in a gaseous state or any or not. We're still on Saturday morning after all. But the fact that you have young children there. Another one of the great things about Star Trek is how it would get kids who watched it for the adventure and the excitement interested in science. And just the fact that they mention antimatter, I mean, they could have been standard bombs or explosives of some kind, but they don't do that. And I love the fact that the show did that.
What I love about this episode in particular, Alan, like you point out, that Star Trek did not talk down to its audience on the Saturday mornings, but at the same time, there is an educational aspect of it that feels organic to the story, just like Dorothy Fontana had an MO to address the concept of euthanasia in yesteryear with young viewers so that they could understand the concept of death of a pet and the importance of it. Now you have McCoy sort of addressing what the human digestive system, how that all works and how this is affecting the Enterprise in the cloud. And it's done in a way where it does not talk down to the audience. But at the same time, if I was a, you know, 7-8 years old watching this, I might be getting some education without even realizing it.
Yeah, Tex Avery, it isn't.
That's exactly right. Although Tex Avery could be educational in strange ways.
Yeah.
We come back in Act Two and we have this conversation about essentially how the Enterprise is being digested. And then we hear there's a message from the governor. And this is heavy. I mean, this is a heavy thing. It starts off, he says,
3.5 hours, Jim. That's not enough. Even if I had the ships available to totally evacuate the planet.
You have time to save some people, Bob.
And then Kirk asks this question, which of course makes me think of the conscience of the king. He asks,
how are you going to choose?
That's a heavy question. Man, Bob Wesley is going to have to choose who lives and who dies out of 82 million people. And he says,
there is no choice, Jim. We'll save the children.
Save the children. At least Bob Wesley is saving the children and not saving the better half, so to speak, like Governor Kotos did in, you know, 20 years before the events of The Conscience of the King.
I just think it's really interesting that we pose an impossible question. Do you tell the people that are all going to die, knowing they might panic but could save a few? Impossible question. We have a solution. Responsible guy who's not going to panic is the leader. Okay. Then we ask a second impossible question. How do you decide who lives and who dies? And our responsible leader has a good answer. We'll save the children. I think that's deep, heavy stuff they're handling really well in this episode.
And that heavy stuff, Alan, is something I thought you handled really well in expanding upon the moral dilemma faced by Kirk and Wesley in your adaptation. Because in your adaptation, Wesley is feeling more of the burden of this decision, more of the facing the death of about 82 million people. And at one point during the book version of this, he snaps at Kirk for being like, oh, you're all safe up there in your starship, before he catches himself.
One of the author's jobs is to make your human characters act human. And nobody's perfect and nobody follows the strictures of a script, hopefully. It's just they have a human reaction to something. And that's something, as we spoke about earlier, that I get to do that they simply don't have time to do in the screenplay. There's a very famous science fiction story from Astounding Science Fiction called The Cold Equations by an author named Tom Goodwin, where a guy on a spaceship has to decide, if I remember correctly, whether to deliver life-saving drug to people on a planet. But the ship is kind of overweight, and there's a stowaway on board, and it's a pretty girl. And does he kill the pretty girl to save the people? Or it poses the same dilemma. So it's an issue that's existed in science fiction for a long time, and it's one of the things that science fiction deals with best.
Agreed.
In 3 hours and 20 minutes, the cloud will reach Mentilles. Millions of people will die. I need your help, gentlemen. Your analyses?
It's a dumb statement to go, look, the guy that directed 14 episodes of Star Trek doesn't know Star Trek. Obviously, he did. He directed some of the greatest episodes. But in writing this script, he shows that he knows Star Trek.
Yep.
And in particular, because now this is, what is it that Kirk, Spock, and McCoy do? What does the crew of the Enterprise do? They reason together to figure out a common problem. And that's where we are now.
And again, this is all being done in an episode that is half as long as Mark Daniels had the luxury, quote unquote luxury, directing back in the late 60s.
We hear that it's now 3 hours and 5 minutes till it reaches Antilles.
Mr. Sulu, take us to that central core area.
Aye, aye, sir.
And if this thing does have a stomach, we just might be able to give it enough indigestion to make it turn away from Antilles.
You know, what I love is about this particular act is, again, the information that we're learning about the Villi. You know, McCoy is bringing a lot to the table. All of the major characters, with the exception of maybe Sulu, all of the major characters shine in this episode in a way that they shined in, like, you know, in The Doomsday Machine. Again, that's Mark Daniels. He knows what he's doing. And he's, in this case, McCoy's way to shine is by saying that the Enterprise is in what corresponds to the small intestine.
Those things growing out of the wall would be similar to villi.
Villi?
The human small intestine is lined with millions of them to absorb nutrients into the body.
There's some really educational stuff here, stuff I didn't know as a grown-up.
And the other thing we find out is that these villi are actually antimatter and essentially antimatter bombs. And now we get at another ticking clock. We have the 3 hours until we get to Mantilles and 82 million people will die. But now we have 21 minutes until we run out of power and we can't fight off the antimatter anymore.
How much time do we have?
21 minutes, sir. But if the indicator goes below 2 anti-kilos, the engines won't regenerate.
You know, Alan, when you're watching this episode new, you know, did it kind of strike you that, like, okay, yeah, there have been episodes that where there was a race against time, like an episode like Obsession, or, you know, we got to stop this thing before it reproduces into thousands. Of course, Doomsday Machine, where Kirk's got to get off the constellation, you know, before it gets eaten up by the Planet Killer. But in this episode, you have two ticking clocks, and like for an animated episode, you really feel the suspense in that.
The ticking clock is an old tried and true device in film, whether it's disarming the bomb as we watch the clock tick down or whatever. And I'm willing to allow that device, you know, in the story because it's integral to the story. And I don't have a problem with that. But what you say about there being two of them makes it that much more interesting.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we've talked about is the difference between a plan that has a little bit of technical stuff in it, but we can still understand, and a plan that's just all technobabble, and I really don't know what anybody's talking about. And I think this is a good example, which is Scotty comes up with a plan. Hey, if it's antimatter, we could bring one of them on board and charge up our system, and Kirk resists it because if it touches anything, we could blow up. To me, even though I don't need to know about particle physics or anything, I get the idea and I get what the problem is.
Absolutely. And again, that's what I always liked about the original series. It didn't resort too much into technobabble. I always knew what they were talking about, where sometimes when I watched, you know, some of the later episodes of Next Generation or Voyager or whatever, and I'm just like, what did they just say? I have no idea. And I just felt like that was like an easy way out, was to sort of like have some incomprehensible solution. Oh, they're not going to understand it anyway, so it'll work. But in this case, Scotty to the rescue. They're moments away from the power drain, and Scotty in true Doomsday Machine form of being a miracle worker to save the day comes up with a great plan to capture antimatter and matter and use it as a way to re-energize the Enterprise power.
Well, and we have a solution, but within the solution is its own problem because it's dangerous. And so they cut the Veli off, they beam it aboard into this force field box, they stick it in the engines. And it's funny, you know, we're watching, the engines kind of look like a giant, like spark plugs into a big, huge V-28 engine or something is kind of how it looks like to me. And it looks like it's powering down and heading into the red, and then they charge it with the Veli and it all works.
Scotty, you've just given the Enterprise and Mantilles a chance to live.
Thank you, sir.
In other words, you've just earned your pay for the week.
No, you can only, what you said about technobabble is true. You only have so much time to explain certain things. And even in an hour-long show, if you spend more than 30 seconds explaining an aspect of technology, you're going to lose people. Unless, you know, they're true, I don't want to say, well, I'll say nerds. But you're just going to lose people because not everybody is interested in that. They're interested in the story, they're interested in the plot, and they're not interested in technical devices like that. I am, and you are, but most people are not. So you do what you can as quickly as you can. The key to all that, to me, is maintain the internal logic. Okay? You don't rub a magic lamp to charge up the Enterprise's engines. It has to be integral to the technology that's in that, in the Star Trek universe and in the story. If it's a little suspect, and if the whole we're inside a body kind of thing is stretched to the limit, okay. But you just don't have time to do all that other stuff. I mean, the Arrival, to quote, to reference Arrival again, the whole thing is about an aspect of soft science, if you will.
Right.
So you have a lot of time to go into those kind of details. You don't hear, so you maintain the internal logic and you move on with the story.
Yeah, I think in the episodes where it doesn't work, it's exactly what you said. It's rubbing the Enterprise like it was the genie in the lamp, and they just go, oh, well, we can rewire the polarity of the deflector shield, and that will, and it's like, and then it'll work. And it's like, I don't know what that meant.
The cloud is now only 42 minutes, 14 seconds from Mantilles, Captain. And we have ascertained an important fact. This being does have a brain.
Now, the next question is it intelligent? And they don't know the answer.
But they do know that the brain is at the top of the core. And mm-hmm. whether or not it is intelligent, and which are still trying to figure that out, Kirk reasons we'll use photon torpedoes to destroy the brain. And then Spock says, hey, wait a minute. If this is a living creature, it's, you know, Starfleet regulations. And Kirk says,
I know the regulations against the killing of intelligent life forms, Mr. Spock. But we don't know this life form is intelligent. And we do know the people on Mantilles are doomed if we don't stop it. If I have to be a judge, I decide in favor of saving Mantilles.
Steve Morris, what did this exchange remind you of?
It's Devil in the Dark. Devil in the Dark is the big one. So we've dealt with whether or not to start a panic, who to save on the planet. We're going to save the children. And now we're dealing with, do we kill this creature to save 82 million lives? And Kirk violating orders. I mean, this episode's got a lot going on for it.
A lot going on, again, for an episode that's half the time. Very impressive. And yes, this exchange, I mean, even though Spock never got to finish what he was going to say, you could almost hear in your head Spock saying, to kill it would be a crime against science, which is a direct quote from The Devil in the Dark. Again, Alan, like, you know, in addition to the moral dilemma faced by Kirk on saving the lives, now you have this moral dilemma that, like, what do we do if this thing is intelligent? Do we have a right to kill it? Like, why was that such an important aspect of what made Star Trek so special?
Well, it makes intelligence more important than just about anything else. It makes sentience more important than just about anything else. It's not a question of money, and it's not a question of accumulating objects. It's a question of, you know, how important is intelligence? This personally to me is why I think it's important for humanity to continue to survive in spite of all of our imperfections, unless we find somebody else out there who is also intelligent. If we do, then I think we can let go of our responsibilities. But right now we have a responsibility. We're the only intelligent, as far as we know, beings around. We have a responsibility to maintain that. And if we run into another intelligence, you know, do we have the right to kill it, even if it wants to kill us? It becomes, I mean, you could do a whole hour episode just on that question. So the fact that they deal with it at all in the context of this 24-minute show is pretty impressive.
Very impressive, yes.
And we come back in Act 3, and now Kirk is having second thoughts. He was clear on what he was planning to do a moment ago, and now he says,
am I doing the right thing, Bones? Once I said man rose above primitiveness by vowing, I will not kill today.
Well, Steve Morris, this moment made me think of two things. Of course, Kirk is referencing something he said to Spock, or rather Anon 7, when he appealed to Anon 7 to stop the war between Amenior 7 and Vendikar in A Taste of Armageddon. What a great line that we quoted many times throughout our deep dives of the original series. We can admit that we're killers, but we're not going to kill today. That's all it takes. But also, Steve and Alan, this moment where Kirk is doubting his decision. He is feeling the burden of command. Here we are now in year 5 of the Enterprise 5-year mission. To back in the earlier days of the voyage of the Enterprise, during Balance of Terror, when Kirk was in his quarters and they were chasing the Romulans back through the neutral zone into Romulan space, where Kirk says, am I doing the right thing? Everyone on the bridge is looking at me, looking to see if I'm going to make the right decision. And Bones, what if I'm wrong? So again, that's very impressive how provocative this episode is, while also tying into so many elements that truly make Star Trek, Star Trek.
So I have a question, and Scott, maybe you know the answer to this. Alan, maybe you know the answer to this. Maybe this is unknowable. Do we have any way of knowing if Mark Daniels wrote that line or if Dorothy Fontana in a rewrite put that line in?
For this episode or for Balance of Terror?
For this episode.
Well, Fontana did a final polish of the script.
Because if Mark Daniels wrote that line, then that shows, first of all, I made a joke about the fact that Mark Daniels directed I Love Lucy. He was the first director on I Love Lucy and directed first couple of seasons, I think. So that is one of the most important directing jobs in television history. And if he wrote this line, that shows a love of Star Trek, because he didn't direct that episode. So that means that he watched the episode and remembered it and liked it. If it's Dorothy Fontana, that's different because obviously she was involved with Star Trek from the beginning. But if he wrote that line, that shows a love of this show. Because the other thing I'm thinking, it's not like he got paid a lot to write this episode of animated television.
That's
he
right.
He must have done this out of love. He must have gone, I love these characters. I love this world. I want to still be involved in it. That's the only thing I could think.
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, I'd be curious to see the earlier drafts to see who wrote what. But regardless of whether it was Fontana or Daniels, both of whom were crucial creative forces making Star Trek the very best it could possibly be. Either case, it is brought back to the fore, which just shows how much both of them, regardless of who wrote what, really understood and love Star Trek. And you know, Alan, when you see, like, I feel like the animated series had more continuity connecting the original series than the original series did itself. Because, you know, Kirk is saying, I asked this question before. You have Bob Wesley showing up from the Ultimate Computer. There is a lot more in season four, which the animated series is regarded as, like, that sort of like brought the original show into the animated show. Like, what was your take on that watching this?
Well, certainly it was season four. I don't think anybody disagrees with that. But you already have by now, after the first three seasons of live action, an established universe with established characters, and it gives you the freedom, in addition to the freedom that animation gives you the freedom to do things that you might want to do that you wouldn't have been able to do on live television because somebody would stop you. When there's less oversight and less, if you will, at stake, financially maybe, then you have a little more, you have a lot more freedom to do things. Mm-hmm. You find this in a lot of animation where people do crazy stuff that they know they'd never get away with in live action. So there's a certain freedom in the animated series that didn't exist in the live-action series.
You know what I think is weird, and it's particularly hitting me in this episode. If you were just going to make a Saturday morning cartoon, most of the audience would be kids, you would probably feel the need to maybe introduce things more than you would feel the need to make callbacks to things from a show that those kids probably didn't watch. And so I really wonder, was part of them going, you know, okay, yeah, this is for kids, it's Saturday morning, but we know there's this audience of college kids and people, science fiction fans, and the people that have been doing the letter writing, we're really writing this for them.
I think I'd give the same reaction that Chuck Jones, who was Warner Brothers' greatest animation director, said when he asked about who his audience was. He said, we're not making these for kids, we're making these for ourselves. And I think you would say that about the writers of the animated series. Admittedly, they have one eye on the audience, but basically, and this episode's a particularly good example, they're writing it for themselves. And if there's callbacks, they're putting the callbacks in there because they're getting a kick as writers out of doing those callbacks.
That's a great point. And I'm agree with that completely.
It's funny. I totally agree with you. And I love Chuck Jones. He's one of my, but the only distinction I would make is when they were making those cartoons, those were for movies and adults were going to see them. Two, they weren't Saturday morning cartoons that were just geared for kids. And of course they were making them for themselves. I totally agree, but I feel like there is a bit of a difference too.
Fair enough.
But guess what? We can't fire torpedoes at this thing's brain. It won't be enough to blow them up.
However, the brain could be completely destroyed if we convert the entire ship to energy aimed at the brain's cortex and expend the energy in one mortal strike.
That sounds like you're telling us to blow up the ship.
I believe that is what I just said, Doctor.
And he said it for the second time in only the first three episodes of the animated series, where once again, threatening to blow up the ship in an episode that, according to the Stardate, takes place before the closest that actually happened, which, of course, was in Let That Be Your Last Battlefield.
And then we get a call from Bob Wesley on the planet, and this is genuinely emotional. Like, in a way that really surprised me, even more so than I found the story of Yesteryear emotional, but it didn't have an emotional moment like this does.
There was some hysteria at the beginning, but most agreed to let the children be taken off first. But it's only
5,000 children out of 82 million people.
And again, kids who are watching this on Saturday mornings are going, wow, 82 million people are going to die except 5,000 kids. And this is the point, Alan, in your adaptation where Kirk says, yes, I know. And Kirk snaps back to Kirk about being safe in your starship. And then he, you know, I'm sorry, Jim, and everything. And like that's a great moment that you expand upon the emotional impact that, like, oh my God, we can only save 5,000 kids. Oh, it's easy for you to say you're up okay in your starship, Bill, safe there. It's a great moment. One expanded on the emotion that Steve was pointing out.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, and the next moment I think is really interesting because he says that they can actually see the cloud approaching. And then Kirk asks,
Bob, where's Katie?
Here with me.
And we find out in a moment that Katie is his daughter and is 11 years old. But what this means, and again, this is handled very subtly, he didn't send his own daughter with the 5,000 kids away from the planet.
Oh, yeah, I know. I didn't realize that. So she's staying with her. Right.
With
him. Mm.
And maybe he made the decision of sacrificing his own child in order for people to believe that this was all on the up and up. Maybe that's what happened.
Amazing that this is all, again, can't say this enough. Pretty heavy for a Saturday morning cartoon.
And now Kirk asks again, is this thing intelligent? Because he's still wrestling with this idea. And intelligence, as Alan, as you brought up, being a key factor of whether or not to kill this thing. And ask if we can do the Vulcan mind touch. And then we get some, again, the technical stuff about how he can't touch it, but we're going to use the ship sensors and jury-rig something. So now it's 7 minutes left. The procedure is ready. Spock does a weird reaching out thing with his eyes closed. And now we hear a conversation where in his thoughts, he says,
you are not alone here. There is someone else. Listen.
And then here's how this happened in my brain when I was watching it. I hear what, and it's a shot of the computer, and I hear Majel Barrett's voice, and I went, the computer is talking.
Yeah.
Because she's the voice of the computer.
It's confusing because not only is Majel Barrett the voice of the computer, but she is the voice of the consciousness of the cloud that is communicating with Spock, doing a mind meld, again, with something that is not human, only instead of touching Nomad, and doing a mind meld with the machine like he did in The Changeling, he is doing a mind meld with the cloud, and he is doing it, I have to say, in a way that this word was not used in 1973. He is doing it virtually. He is doing it because Uhura got hooked into the Wi-Fi of the Enterprise to connect Spock's mind meld with the cloud. So again, here you have all these crew members in 24 minutes really contributing. You have McCoy describing the cloud as being like the human digestive system. You have Scotty figuring out how to fix the engines. You have Spock doing a virtual mind meld with the cloud. And it's Uhura who figures out how to make the virtual mind meld work. That is all extremely impressive.
It's also, this is where I was really thinking of the motion picture, because we're inside some giant creature and Spock is doing a mind meld with it.
Right.
You know, and basically they have to explain what they are, which is we're humans inside this ship, inside of you, and planets that you consume sometimes have these humans on it. She looks at the planet, sees life forms there, but it isn't quite convincing.
Too small.
Explain.
I am small. Some things I perceive too small. Not alive beings.
So I guess she doesn't get it yet. That's where we are right now, right?
She doesn't get that size matters not. She doesn't get that, oh, because they're small, that they're living things. And Spock is trying to say, hey, you know, we are small, but we are living beings and you're killing us.
So now we're going to go for the full mind melt. And Spock stands up.
Oops. He's the cloud. Its thoughts are here.
And Spock walks forward and touches Jim's face, and Bones does not like that. He's worried about Jim. And then Kirk has the idea to show him some images from Earth.
And that is a very Kirk move, by the way.
Yep.
Kirk, like, figuring out a way to appeal to the cloud. So I got to say, so just like so many great moments of the original show, Alan, you have a show, this one of our planets is missing, that is dealing with compassion and dealing with communication. Because like in some of the very best episodes of Star Trek, there's this thing, they don't understand it. It's going to kill all these people, or it's going to kill us. So we have to kill it first, like in The Devil in the Dark, or my personal favorite episode of the original series, which is Metamorphosis. But then through communication, they are able to figure out like what's really going on, and they're able to show compassion by not killing it and by trying to reason with it. They do that with the Horda. They definitely do that with the Companion. And now they're doing it with the cloud in One of Our Planets is Missing. So, Alan, what is your take on how communication and compassion has played such an important role in Star Trek?
Well, you don't see it in a lot of television. You don't see it in a lot of movies. People act and do things according to the script instead of how they might do them as human beings. All of this, of course, references our situation on Earth today. People don't communicate. They don't show compassion. That was one of the things. Star Trek, like much science fiction, is just a mirror of ourselves. And you see that in a lot of these shows. You could substitute a current political situation in multiple parts of the world for what we're talking about in this episode right now. But a lot of people don't make that connection, but you can still show it to them.
Mm-hmm.
And The Devil in the Dark, by the way, was my favorite episode, so I'll just throw that in there.
I was going to ask, and that's a good choice.
It's a very good choice. And I also think that we allow a lot of things to happen in the world just because we don't look at it. But if we looked at the people that those things were happening to, we might have a different reaction. And that's exactly what happens to the cloud right now. By showing the cloud images of Earth, children and people and humans through the eyes of Spock, the cloud suddenly gets it. And even though we're building to the last couple of seconds and we have to self-destruct, Kirk holds on just long enough for it to work.
And by the way, that most of the Earth shots that were in this scene were actually taken from another Filmation TV series from 1973. In this case, Lassie's Rescue Rangers, which was illustrated by George Wheeler. So in terms of showing the cloud images of the Earth, it made me think of, not that this is a particularly great episode, but it made me think of And the Children Shall Lead, when Kirk is showing the kids videos of their families like enjoying themselves.
I told you never to bring up that episode again, Scott.
Alan agrees from that laugh, not one of the better episodes of the original series.
Everything can't be perfect, and everything can't be as good as everything else. You just do the best you can.
Yep. Yeah. Everything can't be City on the Edge of Forever.
The cloud has stopped, sir.
Comprehend, not desire to consume other beings.
And then Spock says, it would be best if you return to your origin, the way you came. Will you do this?
Go back where you came from.
And I think the cloud sounds kind of sad about that.
Well, the cloud sounds like at the end of Beyond the Farthest Star, you know, like sad.
But that character was a bad guy.
Right.
This character is not.
Right.
So I feel a little sad.
Misunderstood. A misunderstood antagonist, which is another crucial Star Trek element.
Spock, what did you perceive?
The wonders of the universe, Captain. Incredible. Completely incredible.
But that is not where you ended the story in Star Trek Log 1, Alan. And in a final coda to Spock's words from the actual finished episode, The Wonders of the Universe, incredible, absolutely incredible. So, Alan, I'm curious, like, what, if you recall your inspiration for this final moment that you gave, like, really going deeper with this final emotional moment. Spock says, someday, Captain, when we are able to protect ourselves a little better, we may be fortunate enough to meet it again or others like it. And Kirk responds, and when that day comes, the ant will stand on its hind legs and converse with the man. Alan, that's pretty damn brilliant.
Thank you again. Well, that's how I feel about science fiction in general. So much of science fiction deals with that idea that, Carl Sagan, you know, in his book, In Contact, and Stapleton in his books, is just the idea that we're just this little tiny creature that's just kind of working its way out of the ooze, and we make a lot of terrible mistakes, and you see this throughout Star Trek, and hopefully we can aspire to be something better before we completely foul up the spaceship that we're on, because we don't really have any other options.
You know, Alan, I got to say, it just hit me that over these years, decades rather, since Star Trek the Motion Picture, you know, so of course you were talking about how Star Trek the Motion Picture, they didn't blow things up. Well, you know, the movie did fine, but it was also very expensive. So they had to make the second movie, Wrath of Khan, better. And what did that movie resort to? A whole lot of things blowing up. But Star Trek the Motion Picture, and I said this during our conversation on Steve's other podcast called The Cinephiles, when we covered Star Trek the Motion Picture, that the motion picture is actually closer to Star Trek than any of the other movies. And the reason for that, Alan, is because some of the finer moments from the original show, like you pointed out about your favorite episode, The Devil in the Dark, in dealing with like something we don't understand, we got to kill it, until they realize through communication that, wait, we got this all wrong. We have to reason and feel compassion for this. And that's what happens in Star Trek, the Motion Picture. They think this cloud is going to destroy the Earth, and then they are able to communicate with V'ger. V'ger is a child, and then turns into, you know, this step in evolution and everything. Like when you were writing your original treatment for it, when it was still going to be phase two, what was it called?
Oh gosh.
Was it In Thy Image?
Yes, it was In Thy Image.
Yeah. Okay.
That was the original title of the treatment. And of course, nowadays, we're starting to really have to come to grips with the idea of genuine artificial intelligence and what that means for our possible future. And of course, take a little story jump here. If the machines do indeed become more intelligent than us and something like V'ger comes along, we won't have any communications problems. V'ger will communicate with the robots will communicate with V'ger, and we'll just kind of be a little sideshow here, a little organic sideshow. There's another story for somebody to write, I suppose.
I remember when Voyager, the real Voyager, crossed through the heliosphere into interstellar space a few years ago, and that, you know, that made news as being the furthest man-made object out there. Of course, every Star Trekker worth their weight in dilithium crystal thought, it's V'ger.
It's happening. About time they made that connection. I just wish that I'd be around long enough, again, assuming we can manage things here on the planet, long enough to see that first contact, because it will come. It might be 10,000 years, though. I mean, a lot of scientists are saying, well, it'll be next year, it'll be soon. I'm not so sure that's the case, but I think it will happen eventually.
I think it'll happen too, and I hope it happens in your and our lifetime, Alan. And I'm just curious, after rewatching the episode, One of Our Planets Is Missing, and after our conversation, you know, what are your final thoughts about One of Our Planets Is Missing?
It's a fine episode, and I know it restates certain things that are in other episodes and to a certain extent in the movie. But it's one of those great questions that we all have, and you can't escape it. And I thought for a 24-minute cartoon episode, did a really good job of dealing with a really big question.
Mm-hmm. Steve, how about you?
So I will confess, Scott, that when we embarked on this next stage of our mission into the animated series, that I was approaching it with some real trepidation. And because the big things that I remember is the reused shots, the reused music, Jimmy Doohan's voice everywhere, the cheapness of it, and all of that stuff. And I was like going, oh, is this going to be painful? And so far, it's been the opposite. And this episode in particular not only had sort of an exciting build to it, but also dealt with multiple heavy, interesting, very Star Trek ideas. So I the dread is fading, and I'm sure there'll be episodes I have criticisms of, but so far, this is really feeling like some fun Star Trek.
I couldn't agree more. I think of the three animated episodes we've done so far, this has been my favorite conversation, because it's for an episode that I feel, while Yesteryear definitely has a big emotional payoff, I feel like One of Our Planets is Missing is Star Trek through and through, inside and out, top to bottom. It is actually very impressive. Another time I'm going to use that word to describe how much they were able to put into this episode with the provocative, weighty questions about, you know, do we have a right to do this? And, you know, how do we justify, you know, what do we do about 82 million people, the burden of command, and how all the characters are able to really shine. They really stuck the landing with One of Our Planets is Missing. And Alan, you stuck the landing with adding that those extra lines to the story for the adaptation. This is a great episode. And Steve, I feel your pain. I was a little nervous about doing our deep dive into the animated series and holding the animated show up to the same level of scrutiny that we did with the original show. And now after three episodes, my fears have faded, and I'm really looking forward to what's next. But before we get into what's next, we have to thank the great Alan Dean Foster for taking the time to talk with us about his career, his involvement with the books and with the motion picture, his thoughts on One of Our Planets is Missing. Alan, where can people find you and follow you on social media?
I have a Facebook page. It shows some of the digital art I've been doing with one of the AI art programs to illustrate some of my books, which has been a lot of fun. And I can't put any of my music there, but maybe Facebook will make that easy one day. I have an old website, which was just built with early HTML, but has a lot of archival information like bibliography, biography, and so forth. People can always go there. And in reference to particularly what we talked about today, had a book come out last year from Centipede Press called The Director Should Have Shot You, which is a memoir, a history of my involvement with novelizations, beginning with the very first one, and of course treats all the Star Trek logs as well, and goes as far as the last one I did, which was the adaptation of Alien Covenant. So if people are curious about my history of work with film and TV adaptations, it's all there. I put it all down because I kept getting asked questions for years and years, and I thought, that's a little bit of history. I ought to get it down so people can read about it when I'm no longer around to do podcasts.
I am on the Centipede Press page for the book right now. This is totally right up my alley, Alan. So you might have made one sale at least, and hopefully a lot more. And if people want to reach Enterprise Incidents, they can do it on our Facebook page. You can just search for Enterprise Incidents. It's Enter Incidents on Twitter. It's Enterprise Incidents on Instagram. And of course, if you haven't subscribed to the show, you should subscribe to the show. It makes everything so much simpler. It just shows up your feed. So if you go to Apple Podcasts, you can subscribe there. If you're not an Apple person, you can do it on Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify. You can go to YouTube and subscribe there, although there's no video, but you can still hear our beautiful voices. And if you want to support the show, you can do it at Anchor, which you can find right in the show notes. You can support the show for as little as 99 cents a month. And if you want to reach me, you can do it at SR Morris on Instagram, SR Morris 1. I'm sorry, SR Morris on Twitter, SR Morris 1 on Instagram. And normally I plug what we're doing on my other podcast, The Cinephiles, but I thought I'd plug a piece of my own work because it relates to this show, which is about 8 years ago now. I did a Great White Shark documentary called Great White Shark Beyond the Cage of Fear. So much of it is inspired by Star Trek because it's really about stepping outside the cage and not being afraid of this animal. You might see it in a different way and not as the threat we all perceive it as. So that's Great White Shark Beyond the Cage of Fear. It's available on Amazon right now to rent.
No, I know you're editing this, but in 1991, I went cage diving with Rodney Fox off South Australia.
Oh, wow.
Rodney is a Rodney is an old friend, and so I am pretty familiar with great white sharks, and I've talked to people in San Francisco, and you and I could have a very long conversation just about great whites, including the story of how, as far as I know, I'm the only person to get a tooth from a live great white, which is a whole episode in, unto itself.
Wow, that's very cool. Scott, how would people reach you?
You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram. Speaking of great white sharks, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Movie Mance. And like Steve said, make sure you subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts. And while you are at Apple Podcasts, or if you haven't yet been to Apple Podcasts, go to Enterprise Incidents right now at Apple Podcasts and leave us a review, because now that we have moved on to the animated series and are doing what we did with the original series, we want to know what you have been thinking so far. If you have not yet done a review for us, please go there now and write a review on Apple Podcasts. We would really appreciate that. And also, we, of course, appreciate any generous donation you can make to support Enterprise Incidents through Anchor FM. So we are now three episodes into the animated series. Up next, we are going to take a journey and pick up the Lorelei signal. That is the next episode on Enterprise Incidents. And it is a landmark episode because guess who takes command of the Starship Enterprise? None other than Lieutenant Uhura. And boy, do I have a great story about that. So please join us for the Lorelei signal next on Enterprise Incidents. And until then, keep going boldly.